Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Today's number is 54 billion. That's how many US dollars in remittances flowed into sub-Saharan Africa just a couple of years ago. That was money sent home by people working abroad. Surely that number has grown given the number of individuals working in international markets. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest report by the Bank of International Settlements that suggests that there is potentially an African sovereign debt crisis. We're going to take a look at that and make sense of that if we can. Then we have a conversation with Denker Capital's Corky Koyman, taking a look at the costs incurred by banks to facilitate or deal with payment declines or transactions, or card transactions in particular, that have declined. We're going to take a look at those costs and see how it is that the banks are navigating that challenge. Then we have a conversation with Alan Gray's CPC Lezwane on how it is that they find needles in haystacks and how it is that they navigate these challenging environments from a volatility perspective as they aim to identify good long-term investments that are worth pursuing. And we wrap up the show, as we do every Wednesday, with an executive lounge conversation. This week's executive is founder and chair at Ario. She also happens to be a nuclear engineer. Dr. Ramatsimela Masango is going to be joining us to get to know her a little bit better.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
That's where we kick off the show, as always, with a sense of market movements that have been taking place throughout the day. This week, we're joined on the line for our markets conversation by Senior Wealth Manager and Investment Member Committee at Private Client Holdings, Warren Bass, to take a look at this, markets rather than get a sense of how it is that they've been moving. Warren, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Markets having quite the interesting midweek movements. If I'm looking at local equity markets versus international equity markets, it's rather positive on the local front, barring, of course, those developments happening out of Asia and Tencent and the implications that has had on Naspers and Prosus locally.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. I think we've had a bad week in the markets, which is good. Quite a bit of interesting news also came out today, just around, which I think is probably one of the main things that people have been waiting for, was the U.S. inflation figures. So, I mean, really, we're watching U.S. interest rates and inflation, which drives everything throughout the world. And inflation was in line with expectations. It came out slightly weaker, the year-on-year growth at 3.4% versus what it was previously at 3.5%. So perhaps giving Kevin Warsh, the Federal Reserve Chairman, now a bit of leeway as not having to raise interest rates, maybe keep them flat, which would be good for markets. So we've seen like the S&P up slightly today. I mean, the SA market was trading fairly negatively, and that actually came back a bit during the day. And the NASDAQ up also 0.4% at the moment. So that's nice, positive news.
Warren, I want to take a look at some other local markets before we get into international markets. MTN gave us a warning around their expectations for revenues and profits potentially to be on the decline. A lot is happening around that business, but the share price sold off quite significantly. I mean, I think one of the reports that I saw suggested that the 5 or 6% decline in the share price meant that a little over 20 billion rands in value was lost in market cap on that particular stock. Quite a significant move there from that perspective, but I suppose at the moment that is very telling of how markets are reading data and news points. As data points come out, if they're exceptionally good, the market might reward companies. If they're not as great, the market really does take this to heart.
Yes, definitely, Jimmy. You know, I think one of the things that is a factor in this is the amount of sort of indexation or passive funds now in the markets nowadays. So that's created, there's quite a lot of automated buying in that. And, big misses by companies in that. You've seen the share price movement exacerbated quite a lot when it happens. I mean, the South African market movements have become larger, but, the foreign markets have actually a lot more than that. So, yeah, definitely a few longer-term factors that are actually influencing that.
Warren, let's take a look at the rand. It was at 16.10 at some point throughout the day. I saw it at about 16.14 a little earlier. It's at 16.15 or so at the moment. The rand also going through its own sets of movements. We know that just towards the end of last month when we got that interest rate decision, the rand went all the way back up north of 16.50. It has since rebounded, suggesting that perhaps rand strength is definitely coming to the party following that interest rate decision by the MPC. It's stronger against the British pound. It's stronger against the euro. Today it's even stronger against the Australian dollar. Rand strength, or the rand rather, holding its own in a very difficult emerging market environment.
Yes, I think there's quite a nice self-help story around South Africa at the moment. So I mean, you see that bullishness in South African bonds and things like our structural reforms and that are sort of starting to, I think, come through and make a bit of a difference. I think that I always look at the currency also in conjunction to sort of maybe like the dollar index and what's happening on some of the foreign foreign markets and that. And, you know, we've seen a bit of weakness, in the dollar index. And I think, you know, consummate with some rand strength. So, you know, yeah, I think it's a number of factors have been affecting it. But, you know, I think South African emerging markets is a bit of a risk on trade throughout the world at the moment as well. So that's all positive for the rand.
Warren, can we take a look at the gold price? You mentioned a risk on sentiment, and the gold price hasn't really, for the last couple of months, been behaving as the typical safe haven we've seen it behave as over the years, potentially having something to do with what's happening in the Middle East and the global tensions and everything. But it's nice to see the gold price back above $4,400 a fine ounce, a level we haven't seen since it's come below that level. We bounced very nicely off $4,000 a fine ounce. The market looking like we could go back to retest $5,000 a fine ounce at the moment. I know it's still very early to see if we go that far up, but even the gold price is benefiting from kind of the shift in sentiment that we're seeing in the world.
Yeah, 100%. I think the gold's an interesting one. It has a very strong structural underpin at the moment with central banks buying more gold rather than US treasuries. And I think really that was a factor of, you know, when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022 and the U.S. confiscated Russian assets, their dollars, that a lot of countries moved to buying more gold instead of holding U.S. Treasury. That's a very strong underpin. And I think recently some of the, you know, gold defensiveness is actually broken down because there were so many retail investors jumping on the bandwagon and buying into ETFs, which really created like some bit of artificial demand for gold. Some of that was shaken out of the system in the last while with the Iran war because people needed to fund sort of, you know, some of their other assets by moving money out of gold. And but I think now that it's kind of reestablished itself a little bit, you know, the sort of same fundamentals. And this decision, this inflation figure, which was a bit softer, maybe looking at the Fed keeping rates on hold, has, given a bit of impetus to the gold price.
Warren, before I let you go, can we take a look at some of the other developments out of the US? Looking at SpaceX today, that share price bouncing quite nicely off of $110 a share. There was a lot of concern around whether or not we'd get back above listing price, and we're kind of wrapping up the tail end of earnings season in the US. A couple of stragglers still reporting on numbers. It's been, by and large, somewhat of a relatively confident earnings profile. I think the only thing that was a bit of a downer in the US was that jobs data that you mentioned at the start of our chat, last week's jobs data, or the start of the month's jobs data, not coming through as strong as expected, and that labor market very telling. But on the company side of it, surprisingly, companies still able to beat estimates, able to still provide a bit of positive sentiment in the markets. How are you reading the US picture at the moment, and is it driving the confidence that we've seen? I mean, the S&P recently touched all-time highs once again. Markets are clearly moving very, very differently at the moment there.
Yeah, without a doubt to me. I think, you know, the way that we look at it, there's been these two opposing forces in the market. One is worries around a stagflationary environment, you know, slowing growth and rising inflation. And then and two versus very strong earnings coming out of the US, really from the AI build-out. And you've started to see that AI build-out, strong earnings growth, actually broaden out in the US economy. I mean, for the first quarter earnings in the US, the S&P earnings were 28% in total, and excluding the large AI tech-related business, about 15 to 18%. I mean, that's just ridiculously strong growth coming out of there. In quarter two, I mean, growth looks like it's going to be around, you know, excluding all those big companies, like over 20%. So, you know, definitely positive revisions there. That's a very key one. So even though the jobs, you know, it's kind of one print, the softer jobs data, there does seem like a fair amount of underlying strength still in the U.S. economy. And, you know, I think as long as there's a sustainability in those type of earnings numbers and that is supporting markets, you know, ahead of whatever other geopolitical issues and that we see in the world.
The geopolitical issues don't seem to be going away, but it does seem as though market participants are finding a way to navigate through them. We'll see how these market conditions continue to unfold and how they impact local and international markets. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Senior Wealth Manager at Private Client Holdings, Warren Bass, joining us to take a look at markets, make sense of what's been happening there, and share his thoughts around what could be coming next.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery, and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system's kinda dear my car. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
What separates a great company from a great investment? And when does quality become too expensive? This evening at 6:45, Siphesihle Zwane, portfolio manager at Allan Gray, joins the SAFM Market Update to discuss the difference between quality and value, the characteristics that give certain companies the ability to compound value over time, and why uncertainty can create opportunities for patient long-term investors. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized FSP.
Did you know? A soil sample gives you a comprehensive understanding of your soil. Through soil, sap, and leaf analysis, Omnia helps turn data into practical, producer-relevant recommendations. Because when you understand your soil properly, you can make better decisions in the field. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The latest Bank of International Settlements bulletin has come out suggesting that the public debt situation in Africa is of serious concern, especially amidst the global headwinds that markets are facing. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for the Advancement of Scholarship at the University of Pretoria, Professor Daniel Bradlow, joins me on the line now to see what we make of this report. Prof, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts around the African debt crisis, is it isolated to Africa? Is it something that, I suppose the report particularly focuses on Africa, but is it something that is distinctly different from what's happening everywhere else in the world?
Good evening and thanks for having me. It's not only an African problem. It's a problem of many developing countries, but there is a particular African dimension to it, I guess. There are about 20 or 21 countries that the IMF thinks are at risk of being in debt distress, which doesn't mean that they necessarily will have a debt crisis, but that they are under pressure to meet their debt obligations. And so that does create a problem for the country, for the continent. And then in addition, there's some countries which are already either in debt, have defaulted on their debt, such as Zambia or Ghana, which are now working their way out, or countries like Senegal, which are in serious risk of defaulting and are having a real debt crisis at the moment. So it is a varied picture. And because of the situation in the Gulf and the El Nino effect, the risk that African countries could experience more debt crises is significant.
Prof, let's look at that Middle East development and how it is that that's potentially impacting the market. You mentioned, of course, that it has the potential to increase the debt crisis situation. But if we look at those events, I mean, those events are external of what's happening on the African continent. I suppose in part, they do have an impact on infrastructure development and the goals that some of the countries have, but also potentially on conversations like trade. How is it that those ongoing developments that are unfolding in the Middle East are going to potentially put more pressure on the African continent?
Well, because firstly, because of the fact that the Straits of Hormuz are closed, it means the chance for African countries to access the oil that they need is becoming more challenging. The price of oil, as we know, is going up. The price of fertilizer is going up. So that has knock-on effects to countries in the region who have to spend more either subsidizing oil, or the population has to live with the inflation that follows from higher prices. And that puts pressure on the government budgets, in either through more spending on the subsidizing of these things, or on the fact that they're getting less revenue because the economy's in crisis. So it is causing problems. The El Nino could affect that as well, because it could cause droughts in certain parts of the continent. So both of those effects, if they go on, will have a significantly negative effect on African countries. In addition, the uncertainty that's being caused by all this means that markets are less willing on average to lend money to African countries. And so they're becoming more dependent on a relatively smaller pool of potential finance.
Prof, that pool of finance might be growing smaller, but we are seeing that countries on the African continent aren't all sitting idly by. Some governments are taking important policy steps to mitigate some potential adverse impacts of what might be happening around the world. Some governments are very proactive around how it is that they're utilizing the funds that they're obtaining from financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. How is it that African countries are deciding to navigate these challenges differently? And could that be potentially the difference maker between avoiding a sovereign debt crisis as a country and potentially accessing capital that is critical at a time like this and using that to improve the country?
So there definitely are moves that African countries are making. A number of them are borrowing from new sources. So, for example, Kenya swapped some of its debt from dollars into Chinese yuan. A number of other countries are looking at doing that. Countries are borrowing and looking at borrowing from Indian markets or the Turkish markets. And the biggest development is that more and more African countries are raising most of the money they need in their domestic markets. And so that helps them manage the exchange rate risk, so they don't have to be as dependent on the dollar and what happens to the dollar. So that's a positive development. It has some negative effects because the cost of domestic debt tends to be higher and the maturity of the debt tends to be shorter than some of the external debts. And it's definitely much more expensive than borrowing from the World Bank or from African multilateral financial institutions. So there's a plus and a minus, I guess, from the domestic debt, but it is opening up more possibilities and reducing some of the dependency on foreign markets.
Prof, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on what you make of those borrowing habits. You touched on the fact that borrowing is increasingly coming from diverse sources, potentially new sources, and you mentioned the likes of China coming to the party there. We know that the China-Africa conversation has been developing as well around how it is that Chinese trade is being influenced or is being navigated on the African continent with things like change of currencies, but that's also happening around the world as well. I want to get your thoughts on that kind of influence. Does that represent a fundamental shift in how it is that African countries might be engaging with global markets from what we knew historically? Is there just more choice out there available in the market? Or is it that markets are finding that, okay, when one door is being pushed closed, then this might be the only door open? If not, this is the preferred door from the onset.
I suppose it's a mixed picture. I mean, the general truth is that countries need to be showing that they're managing their economies well and that they can use whatever they borrow effectively. So then that gives confidence to people to lend, and also that helps the economy grow. We're going through a change in the world, so the opening up of new possibilities is definitely there. And as you said, China, India are becoming new sources of funds. There are a growing number of institutions on the African continent that are lending more and are playing a more active role in lending to African countries. So that opens up new possibilities. But if the global economy is in an uncertain situation, that definitely creates constraints on the ability of African countries to borrow externally. And so the use of domestic markets becomes greater. One of the challenges, of course, is that for many African countries is that they're small. So their domestic markets are not very big or very liquid. And so that makes raising funds domestically much harder. That's not a problem for South Africa because we have deep and liquid financial markets. But on the continent, it is becoming more challenging. And I think the lesson at the end of the day is that African countries will have to cooperate more and use more African resources. And as you say, use more intra-African trade through the Continental Free Trade Agreement and things like that as a way of developing the resources for ourselves on the continent.
Some interesting times we find ourselves in, and navigating through those times is potentially how we avoid sovereign debt crises. And we'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Professor Daniel Bradlow, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Advancement of Scholarship at the University of Pretoria, joining us to take a look at the latest report by the Bank of International Settlements that Africa could be facing a debt problem.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm at Atlanta Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
A recent study found that South African banks are incurring around 3 million rands a year on declines that affect card transactions beyond their control. We're going to take a look at this in a bit more detail and see if we can make sense of it with our resident banking specialist executive at Denker Capital. Kokkie Koimani joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Kokkie, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. It's hard to believe that the banks could incur such significant losses on transactions where they have very little control.
Yeah, look, it's obviously a calculated number, and they do it on a few estimates. But essentially, it's what the report does, and it looked at quite a few countries, mostly emerging market countries and Europe, and it found that the card transactions that are declined by banks, and we can come into the reasons of why that happens, potentially loses them revenue, as a client might be using card A from bank A, the transactions declined, and then the client switches to card B from bank B. And so bank A loses that transaction. And that amount is estimated to be about 3 million rand. Interesting, in Europe, that amount is significantly lower. But we can come back to that later. But the main thing is that the card transactions are lost only if, obviously, the client does switch to another bank for that transaction, or worse, permanently switches to another bank.
Now, I'm talking 3 million in the scheme of how much it is that our banks are generating in revenues doesn't seem like a lot. But when you start to look at that amount as just potentially one line item that the banks are exposed to here, it could speak to a significant problem if we're looking at the rate at which, or if we're looking at the percentage at which the banks are charged for these transactions. When we look at the interbank or the interbank exchanges that take place here, where does South Africa sit compared to other global banks?
Yeah, we actually feel expensive. And funny enough, in this case, it's not the banks. I know, Revolut and guys like that and Wise are coming in and trying to cut that. And the banks, I think, have made fairly good margins on international card transactions. But the main culprit is actually really MasterCard and Visa, who set a very high interchange fee. And interesting why, for instance, in Europe, the interchange fees are so much lower than here, because in those countries, the regulators have capped MasterCard and Visa to very low percentages, 0.2 or 0.3. Interesting, US, Canada is also fairly high, 1.75%. But in South Africa, it's even higher than that because of the MasterCard Visa interchange fee, as I said, but also because of the volatility of the currency. So the banks have to protect themselves against volatility of the currency. Well, so they say. and I suppose it makes sense. If you're doing a transaction between South Africa and the UK or South Africa and US and the rand plays a part, then that the potential loss to a bank of the currency suddenly moving is a lot bigger and the risk of that is bigger than, let's say, if you're doing a transaction between the Netherlands and France, where there is no currency at play, or the Netherlands and the UK, where the pound and the euro more or less move in tandem. So the banks protect themselves against the currency potential loss as well. And just by the way, what is interesting, more and more banks have started offering clients a card, especially for when you travel, with multiple pockets. In other words, you can have a euro pocket, you can have a pound pocket, you can have a dollar pocket. So when you travel and you land in London, you can move money from your euro pocket or your rand pocket to pound. And from while you're in London, you do all your payments from that pound pocket. So you actually pay in local currency, reducing the fees. But I think the more important question is, and I'm sure you're going to ask me that, is, you know, are the banks, are the systems good enough? And why do these declines happen? I've been asking around a bit, and even your people I know, the most card declines often happen when you are in an area where there is poor reception and the response time is too slow. Or sometimes when, because the banks use all kinds of algorithms or behavioral analytics, as they call it, where there's a pattern that the computer picks up. Now, remember, the computer gets thrown millions of transactions almost per minute. And so the computer is trying to scan all these transactions and immediately picks up a pattern that says, yes, so this looks suspect. Rather be safe than sorry. And they block it. Now, fraud relative to card decline transactions, I think the ratio is about 700 to 1. So, you know, the risk of fraud is much bigger to the banks than losing that particular transaction if it is a fraud.
Well, Mkoki, can we take a look at the card issuing companies themselves? You touched on Visa and MasterCard, and I think they play a role in this as well. You mentioned their rates in the US, and I can imagine, given that both companies are US listed and US founded companies, that would be a separate conversation. But globally speaking, there aren't a lot of card issuing companies, and I suppose this also then limits from a transaction fee perspective, what rates are charged outside of those regulatory interventions that you mentioned earlier?
Totally. It hit it on the nail, because effectively Visa and MasterCard have what we call a duopoly, like a monopoly between two players. And there's been a lot of attacks on them in the US in trying to break that. But look, having those international rails, as they call it, you think of a railway line with a train, and you know, you've got those rails that the train can run on. So, you know, those rails that allow you to transact wherever you are in the world. You can go to Argentina or you can go to Mongolia and you can present your card, and the merchant in the US or the product provider or whoever between whatever part in the world, the other part in the world gets accepted and gets paid. And so Visa and MasterCard have obviously spent a lot of money over the years to build that. And so they are mostly charging too high a fee now to recoup expenses that were incurred long, long ago. It's very interesting why you ask that question as well, because that is where the big threat to them now is coming from blockchain and tokens and stable coins, where you know, your whole move towards not needing a bank or not needing a Visa, MasterCard to move money offshore. Your problem is always, if you do use MasterCard, Visa or bank, if something goes wrong, you've got someone to phone. As soon as you use blockchain or crypto, you know, you haven't got anybody to phone. And that's why it will take for quite a while. But you're quite right. Visa and MasterCard, in the countries where their fees are not kept, the fees are fairly high.
Mkhokhi, before I let you go, I want to take a look at South Africa dealing with these particular risks. I mean, we've got organizations like the South African Banking Risk Information Center. We've obviously got the South African Reserve Bank that looks at these sorts of transactions. We've got the Payments Association of South Africa. We've got a yes. lot of financial services bodies and parties that are able to potentially provide some form of solutions or some form of interventions here around how it is that we deal with these transactions. Thankfully, I suppose at the moment, the banks aren't too eager to pass on these costs to consumers. Where they can, they do absorb them. Where consumers are able to take on some of their charge, the consumer does take on their charge. But how do we look at this particular problem from a South African perspective, understanding that as an emerging market, we are still subject to the likes of the duopoly that you mentioned?
Yeah. Now, there's a lot happening, and the Reserve Bank is actually very proactive in a lot of changes that they're trying to bring about. One of them is to move towards a cashless society. That will take quite a while. But, you know, so that means more card transactions. And even then, it means more debit card. And by the way, debit card interchange fees are obviously lower than credit card interchange fees because the risk is lower. Credit card, you've got a fraud risk, a bad debt risk. I think the important thing in South Africa as well is that we are a smaller country, so the number of transactions are smaller. That means your infrastructure is more expensive. But you are finding more and more players coming into the market. And also where the Reserve Bank's playing a role is in the local market and in SADC countries to use PayShap, which they're wanting the banks to almost do card-to-card transactions or peer-to-peer or consumer-to-consumer payments to be close to free, so as to encourage people to take money, rather use a card than money. But back to your original question on terms of the transactions declined, maybe one important statistic I forgot to mention, it's the South African rate of declines is about 0.5% according to the report. That means 1 in 200 transactions get declined, which isn't too bad if you consider the risk of fraud that the banks are trying to combat. And again, back to the original problem with where the most expensive part is, it's 59% of frauds are on credit card transactions that have an international leg. So as soon as you either travel internationally, do a payment, or you pay internationally, then the fraud actually picks up dramatically. I suppose the amounts are higher, and that's what makes it more lucrative for your criminals to target those transactions. But so there's a lot happening, and I think the Reserve Bank is doing what it can to, especially on the lower end of the market, reduce card transactions. And I think the competitive market, players like Revolut coming in when they do, and just inside South Africa, more and more players means that there is more and more pressure on those wider margins to be reduced, and also for the banks to continuously try and be more efficient in what they do.
Identifying efficiencies and making sure that fraud transactions don't continue to cost consumers. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Director at Denker Capital, Mkhokhi Kooiman, joining us to take a look at the fees incurred by banks for fraudulent card transactions.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing, Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. Markets continue to remain volatile, and amidst this volatility, questions are being asked around quality, valuations, good investments, bad investments, and everything in between. We're going to see if we can navigate through this and make sense of how it is that we find needles in a haystack, so to speak, with portfolio manager at Alan Gray, Sipisitle Zwane. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of the markets. Sipisitle, lovely having you on the show. As always, thanks so much for taking the time. There seems to be a growing tension between what investors consider quality and what that quality looks like if we have to represent it as a valuation. What seems to be driving these tensions and perhaps creating this misalignment?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show, Jimmy. And it's interesting times, I think, especially in a South African sort of environment where, you know, some of these call it higher quality businesses tend to trade on very high valuation multiples. So be that price to book, price to earnings, people are willing to pay up quite a bit for them. Versus, you know, in the old school way of like Warren Buffett's investing style back in the day, they used to call it value investing, right? So paying very low multiples of earnings or anything else for businesses was their way of doing things. Our style is more about valuation driven. So, you know, sometimes you should pay up for businesses. Sometimes not paying up for businesses is a bad thing to do. So, you know, sometimes you miss great opportunities by not paying up for businesses. But then the tension there is that everyone knows a good business is a good business. So you have to dig in really deep to find the good businesses that people aren't placing on very, very high multiples.
Specifically, speaking of good businesses, I can imagine one of the key measures of a good business is a business that's able to be around in the markets a long time. You mentioned Warren Buffett, and I can't help but think a lot of the businesses he invested in, the likes of Coca-Cola, they were known as dividend kings, paying out dividends for many consecutive years. And these sorts of companies have almost built up an ability to grow and compound growth over long periods. If you're looking at investments and you're looking at the market and you're looking at all this uncertainty, how do you start to identify companies like that that have the potential to potentially compound their growth or potentially be good long-term investments? What starts to be a criteria or a filter point that you look at when looking at these businesses?
So, I mean, those things tend to be the easier part, right? So, you know, you can look at earnings growth over a long period of time and then how much does it cost to grow those earnings. So what I mean by how much it costs to grow those earnings, if you can grow your earnings by 100 rand today, but it costs you 100 rand to do that, I mean, that's very easy, right? If you give me R1 billion, I'll give you some revenue. But the cost of growth is quite important. So if a business can, you know, reinvest very little to grow their earnings, or if they reinvest a lot, they grow their earnings quite a bit. So companies are able to grow earnings at a cheap cost, whether it be, you know, by putting in less fixed cost or by spending less capital or spending less working capital than the next company, are able to grow value and earnings over very long time periods of time. But the other thing we look at is, you know, it's a similar thing, a moat. So the competitive advantage, how good is a company at protecting that competitive advantage? And that almost tends to speak to the durability of that earnings growth. So, you know, it's all good and well to grow earnings very high for 2 years and then people pay a very high multiple for that. But if, you know, in year three, those earnings fall quite a bit, the market tends to punish businesses for that quite a bit. So, you know, looking at the traditional valuation metrics, are you able to grow earnings over very long periods of time and defend that earnings growth is where we tend to look.
But specifically, sometimes when companies fall or when companies experience setbacks, that's external environments that's not necessarily their doing. How do you start to then, from an investor point of view, look at those setbacks in particular? Do you take every setback as a setback or some of them more serious? And how do you start to then use that as part of your investment thesis to potentially identify which companies are on the right path that might be having a temporary setback versus companies that, for example, are having serious concerns that need to be looked at and potentially steered away from?
So that's the fun and difficult part of investing, is that we all have, you know, a list of these businesses that we love to own. You know, you sleep better at night if you're a shareholder in ShopRite and being a shareholder in some of the other retailers in South Africa, for example. But the valuation multiples tend to be higher. So you almost, we call it having, like, sharpening our pencils, but almost keeping a sharp pencil at all times. So having a view on businesses, even if you don't own them in the portfolio. So when things change, when the wobble happens, and wobbles tend to happen quite often in the markets, then you're ready to actually take advantage of that. I mean, sometimes I can mention some examples of some wobbles. So maybe like, you know, around 2018, ShopRite was having some wobbles. They were implementing like a SAP program. They were doing IT costs. There was some protests there. And then they got out of that with a better IT system than most people, better data than most people that they used to roll out 6060 and use their data advantage quite well. So, you know, another example would be something like, you know, short-term insurance. Every time there's, you know, hail or very bad rains, sometimes like a share like OUTsurance will sell off. But, you know, the hail and rain actually reminds people that they need to have insurance. So then they're more willing to pay up for the insurance, and then the revenue grows. So if you have a slightly longer term view and have a good idea of what the actual value drivers of the businesses are, you're able to actually get really excited when the wobbles happen, because that creates a good opportunity to buy, you know, very high quality compounders at decent valuations, which is always a better place, because time is your friend with compounders, right? So, you know, a business that is losing its value is not something that's great to hold over a very long period of time. But a business that's growing value, even if you get it a little bit wrong over time, by growing its value, it actually helps you quite a bit. You know, it increases your sort of discounts or increases your, you know, your chances of being right over the longer term.
Sipe, before I let you go, I want to take a look at how it is that you leverage that time aspect that you mentioned. You touched on the fact that time is your greatest friend, especially when we're looking at long-term investing. I want to get a sense of perhaps how it is that patience starts to weigh in on identifying opportunities, because when you look for these opportunities, you start to look at them or look for them from a different lens if you are thinking about it from a long-term perspective. How then do you start to identify and isolate opportunities once you've gotten that time factor right?
Yeah, I mean, I could give you a few very long-term examples, right? So there's a time, I think it would have been early 2000s, everyone was saying that Clicks has saturated the market for pharmacy already, and they can't grow stores as much anymore. And you look further on and you look at the consolidation theme there, for example. So, you know, there's a lot of mom and pops pharmacy stores that struggle to compete with the bigger stores, and because they can leverage their scale to have cheaper, you know, front of shops good, so the Vaselines and things like that they have cheaper and have a very good experience in their pharmacies. So you look at those sort of things, you look at the long-term trends, you look at what had happened in other markets. You're like, okay, if people feel like it's saturated now, how does it look in the US? How does it look in the UK? Why can't we have, you know, 60%, 70% corporate-owned pharmacies as well? And why would this business not be able to do that? And then, you know, fast forward a few years later, and you realize that they've actually been able to roll out significant amounts of stores. So, you know, sometimes looking at today's, you know, issues and then thinking, okay, actually there's some white space in markets that companies can grow into is a good place to look. So pulling back, looking at the longer term trends, comparing it to other markets is a good place to start. Meaning another example could be, it tends to trade at a very high multiple, but, you know, if you look at Capitec, right? So if you had to look at it 10 years ago and what they've become today, businesses that are able to plug in things. So what you buy today is not really what's going to be in the future. You know that they have an ability to roll out products very well into a very big retail client base and do it at a cheap cost. So always being aware that, you know, if they have a wobble today in just one part of the business, you know, in 10 years from now, they might be doing 2, 3, 5 more products that they're able to roll out very well on a very big client base and have done that, you know, successfully in the past.
Differentiating between quality, value, and successful businesses is how it is that a long-term investor should be looking at markets, especially at these current volatile times. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray, Sipe Sihlezwane, joining us to take a look at value investing and a long-term mindset. The segment was brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. With over 5 decades of investing experience, Allan Gray remains focused on building long-term wealth for clients by pursuing long-term returns without taking undue risk. Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
Executive Lounge, where top leaders share their business insights and life lessons on SAFM.
In continuing to celebrate Women's Month, we thought we'd keep up with the theme of finding remarkable women to showcase them to our SAFM audience. This week for our executive lounge, we've done exactly that. We have found a woman who might be one of very few in her field of choice. She currently holds a PhD in nuclear engineering. That's probably the easiest thing to identify about my guest. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Rama Tsimela Masango to take a look at what it is that she does beyond being the chairperson of a company that she founded and beyond leading an academy that she's built over many years. Dr. Masango, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Nuclear engineering, how did that come about?
Good evening, Jimmy, and thank you so much for having me. Nuclear engineering, I think nuclear found me. I studied chemical engineering at the then Cape Technicon, I think it's called CPUT now. And when I was looking for a job, I found work at Kuberg. And when I got there, as terrified as I was being in the nuclear space, I actually loved it. And I wanted to know more. I wanted to learn more. And that's how I really became even more interested, and I wanted to study further. And so that time there wasn't as many opportunities to study locally, so I decided to study out of the country. Yeah.
Dr. Masango, tell me about how it is that you then come back after obtaining your PhD in the US. You come back, you build Oreo, you build Mzesi Academy. Take me through what then happens from your perspective coming back to South Africa with all of the skills that you've obtained, and you think, this is how I want to make a difference in the country.
No, indeed. Coming back home was not even a question I pondered a lot on. I knew I needed to come back. At the time when I returned, we were designing a pebble bed modular reactor. So we were quite excited about it. The whole world was watching us do it. So coming back was very important for me. But I knew that my journey was not just for me. I had, young people in the country that I think needed a lot of, encouragement, role models. So that's why I'm still here and we're doing what we are doing. So, yeah, I do a lot of things, but it's really with the intention to spread myself, to encourage others. Particularly young girls, the youth, because the youth of today, generally, there's a lot more challenges. I think that they're facing a lot more challenges than we did, I think. And if we are there to really hold others' hands to say we can walk this journey together, we can encourage them, we can help them to reach their heights as well. It's important to me.
Dr. Masango, while we're on the topic of work, I want to get your thoughts on the nuclear situation in South Africa. There have been many a debate around whether or not nuclear power should be added to our power mix, whether or not we should transition all the way to renewables, how we balance things out around the energy conversations in the country and the just energy transitions that we're going through. I want to get your thoughts as somebody who arguably has experience in this sector. What do you think about where we find ourselves at the moment?
For a start, Jimmy, I think our policy is very clear, the energy mix, and nuclear is part of that energy mix. We have been operating Kuberg for many decades, and we've been doing so safely, so we understand nuclear. There's a need for baseload energy, there'll always be, so there's a space for nuclear, I believe, I strongly believe so. However, it doesn't displace other opportunities and other solutions. And that is why actually in Ario, we are focusing on renewable energy solutions. So it's this room, this space, and that's why even our policy talks about the energy mix. So I feel very strongly that once we understand, I think part of our challenge, perhaps those of us in the nuclear space, we perhaps don't engage more with the public for others to understand what we're really talking about. I think the concern is always the cost, safety, and issues like that. But I think we probably do have a responsibility to engage more with the public so that there is an understanding that we are not saying one and not the other, but we're saying there's actually room. Energy is very, very important for the development of our country, not only our country, by the way, even for the continent. So we have to be looking a wider spectrum of solutions.
Dr. Masango, when you're not fixing the energy problems of the continent, what is it that you look at to de-stress, to unwind?
I do a lot of things. I am a mother, I have children, I'm a wife, but I do other things as well. I'm a gym fanatic, I love working out. But I think what always is of interest to me, and I take every opportunity when I can to really engage with young people. I strongly believe in mentorship. Every opportunity that I can get to engage with young people, to encourage them, to help them see the brighter side of things, it's always very, very important for me. So I get involved in other things, be it, you know, in the community, in the church, at work, you know, engaging with, you know, our team here to help them see that they also have an opportunity to reach greater heights. It's something I'm very, very passionate about.
Dr. Masango, let's talk about Mzesi Academy. The academy, obviously born out of this passion and out of this need to share yourself with the world and to impart the knowledge that you have and to help bring up the next generation wherever you can. When the academy was started, where did you find was perhaps the biggest learning gap for you in building such an institution?
The reason why we actually started the academy was in realizing that, you know, I have a business partner who's a nuclear physicist as well. But it was in realizing that each time we talk about nuclear, there's a discomfort, there's a level of uneasiness. And we realize that the uneasiness comes from a lack of understanding. You know, when you think nuclear, you know, we always take that term to, you know, the military side of things. Yet when we talk nuclear energy, nuclear technology, we want people to understand that there's a positive side of it. You know, there's the nuclear power, there's nuclear technology, there's nuclear medicine, you know, for diagnosis, for treating cancer and so on. So the intention of the academy was really to train and to bring awareness and to do it in a simple language that doesn't push people away to say, oh, it's them again with nuclear, but to get people interested, particularly young people. I still say if nuclear was introduced to me when I was young, I would have even gotten into it much faster. I stumbled on it by chance. But when more and more young people get to understand about it, they will actually make a choice, you know, to join this field because it's quite interesting and fascinating for some of us.
Dr. Masango, what's your favorite meal to cook for your children?
Yeah, I guess that will be mac and cheese.
Is that their favorite
it
meal?
It's because it's their favorite, yes. But it's also quick.
Where do you find the time to do all of the things that you do from a day-to-day basis? I mean, we touched on the fact that, of course, you're chairperson of ARIO, the academy is there, you're a full-time mom as well. You're answering all the questions around balancing a career and a family life. And how do you strike that balance? What for you starts to become important? And how do you kind of filter out the things that are less important to you?
There is no right or wrong. There is no specific formula. But I think what remains important is the balance, that term balance. And no one else can define the balance for me. And the balance changes, and I'll tell you why. It's because on a particular day, if I am preparing for a board meeting, for instance, I won't go to gym at the time when I normally would go because what is important at that particular time, I need to do it. It's different for different people. But for me, I think you have to be able to find a way to actually do what is important. It could
finding balance is critical, and imparting knowledge is another aspect of sharing yourself with the world. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Dr. Ramazamela Masango, managing founder and chairperson of ARIO, joining us for this week's Executive Lounge.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
And that's the show for today, folks. If you missed any of the conversations, you know exactly where you can catch up on them. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by with the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed, of course, by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. It also means from my side, Good night.